Let me say that there's one thing that has not been mentioned in my CV. Sometimes I see myself as an eccentric Christian. I was affected very much by the famine and war that struck Ethiopia in the 80s. I was the general secretary of a small church in Eritrea, and I was very much involved in the response to the drought, the famine, and the war. And you know, as you live in that kind of situation, somehow people's hearts are touched. And sometimes the wound is there. It becomes permanent in a way. And so that kind of situation has affected me for a long time. And wherever I go, I reflect on that kind of situation. Why poverty and war? And I've been working on this issue for quite a long time, and this was one part of the reflection. And let me also tell you about a crazy thing I did. When I left the Institute for Ecumenical Research in Strasbourg in 1976, I decided to be a farmer. The reason for my decision was that I wanted to do something on a personal level to somehow attack the problem of poverty. How do I, as a Christian, with a social conscience, deal with the issue of poverty? So I became a farmer for 7 years. And as you can imagine, a professor becoming a farmer, it was a disaster. And I don't know how I have survived so far, I must say, because it was a very traumatizing experience. Anyway, I got my way out and became a senior research professor, a research officer at the Life and Peace Institute in Nairobi, and this is a result of my reflection. So it is a kind of a result of a lifelong reflection on the issues of poverty, underdevelopment, violent conflicts, and religion. To begin my presentation, allow me to use a quotation which has served as a kind of a text to my book. It's from an American journalist who reported a question and answer session with the former president of Liberia, Mr. Charles Taylor. The writer, Mr. Howard French, presents his exchange with the former president as follows. Exuding haughty self-contentment, Charles Taylor seated himself in a high-backed rattan chair. When he began to speak, it was, as usual, pure bombast. And Charles Taylor says, "We must take a moment to thank God, for this popular people's uprising was in reality God's war, jihad, if you will." Then French comments, "Almost every Liberian had lost his livelihood. People were living in abject poverty and degradation, without a formal economy or even a government. For all of this, the only thing Taylor saw fit to say about the destruction he had wrought was that it had been God's plan." Then the writer asks, "Isn't it outrageous for someone who has drugged small boys, given them guns, and trained them to kill, to call this God's war?" I asked, "How dare you call the destruction of your country in this manner and the killing of 200,000 people God's war?" In truth, it wasn't really a question, but Taylor knew He couldn't allow this to be the last word. And he says, I just believe in the destiny of man being controlled by God. And wars, whether man-made or what, are directed by a force, he sputtered, momentarily confused. And so, when I say it is God's war, God has his own way of restoring the land, and he will restore it after this war. God's war, jihad. In the contemporary world, one finds that the holy warrior, or jihadi in Arabic, occupies the center stage in religion and politics. It is the militant with a religious mission who is the dominant actor around which everything seems to revolve. In this violence, not even the sacred spaces are spared. In fact, they themselves have become the preferred battlefields of the holy warrior. There are a number of such examples from sub-Saharan Africa. During the genocide in Rwanda, many Tutsis and moderate Hutus fled to church buildings, hoping to find a sanctuary in the church. Once assembled, the custodians of the sacred place, in this case the clergy, invited the genocidaire to the church and delivered the refugees of the sacred to orgies of massacres. Defilement of the sacred space has been taking place in many places. Normally, this would have been a scandal. Not anymore. In the post-conflict skirmishes that took place in Kenya between December 2007 and January 2008, a group of terrified people who took refuge in a church building was torched to death. In the case of Sudan, one report says that the government permits its security forces to bomb and attack Christian churches, schools, hospitals, and missions throughout the Nuba Mountains and the south, as well as mosques in opposition areas of eastern Sudan. Opposing groups were ready to fight in the process of ownership of the sacred ground and destroy it in the process. Henceforth, the sacred has become a hostage of politics in the name of religion. The sacred space is increasingly becoming an area where violence takes place to make a political statement or to express a political opposition. The cumulative effect of such violation of the sacred is the defamation of the sacred. In all the cases that were cited, politics was religionalized. There was no sanctity anymore. Religionized politics dares commit sacrilege by means of violence with impunity in the name of the sacred. In reflecting on violence, R. Scott Appleby has written of the ambivalence of the sacred. In my opinion, he focuses more on the act of violence. He discusses the arguments for and against acts of violence by leaders and followers of religion. Without taking great distance from Appleby's analysis, I place more emphasis on the actor or actress instead. The ambivalence which is highlighted in this context is in connection with the actor himself or herself, the holy warrior, the one who is aspiring to attain sainthood or compliance with the will of the sacred through one specific act of violence. The spotlight falls on the instrument of violence and the ambiguity that hangs on one's head. The ambivalence in this connection is that the holy warrior could turn out to be an infidel, one who twists and deforms the norms of the faith for which one apparently fights and for which one dies. In the quest of living according to the will of God, the interpretation of respective scriptures becomes crucial. The holy warrior commits one's act of holy mission on the basis of a certain understanding of scripture. There are also others in the faith, either inside or outside, who contest such an interpretation on the basis of a certain understanding of the same faith. Therefore, the scriptures in question become the battlefields of interpretation. On the basis of any given interpretation of scriptures, the holy warrior could either become or be justified in one's actions or be declared an infidel. The forum for such a declaration, in my opinion, is certainly the discourse on the faith in a public square. I scour sub-Saharan Africa for my case studies. The case that offers a sort of a paradigm is the one in South Africa. The South African system of apartheid is a classic case of a regime that was inspired and based on religion. The political system that was established in that part of Africa was expounded on the basis of a certain understanding of the Christian faith. The Afrikaner community defined its identity on the basis of the Christian Bible. In their understanding of the faith, they appropriated the history of the people of Israel and made it their own. Their Egypt was the period of suffering under the British. In order to end what they saw at the time of slavery, they embarked on their exodus from the land of slavery. They call it the trek. They passed through their Red Sea when they crossed a river called the Blood River. They encountered the Zulus on the way and fought their holy war against infidels. Their victory was celebrated and sealed through a covenant with their God. They built a church which commemorated this sacred victory and became a national day celebrated every year, just like the Exodus. When they entered another land, they saw themselves as the chosen people of God. As such, they had the right to dispossess the local inhabitants, just as the Israelites were said to have done when they came to the promised land from Egypt. They took the choice line, made the local inhabitants hewers of wood and drawers of water, and subjected them to their political whims. All this was done in the name of God. As the Afrikaners established themselves in the land, the church and state conspired to evolve a political system which was built on the basis of religious convictions and sanctioned by a particular interpretation of the faith. The official policy of apartheid was promulgated in 1945 and consecrated the separation of races as a God-given and God-sanctioned political ideology. Henceforth, violence became the instrument to impose such an ideology on the others. The proponents of apartheid first declared the existence of homelands or Bantustans. The basic policy was that on the basis of the faith, the separation of races has to be maintained because it is based on the will of God. In this hierarchy, the white race has to have the upper hand because such is also the will of God. Such a system extended itself far and wide and maintained itself through violence. It extended to Namibia and found an ally in the former Rhodesia. It is also fought fiercely at the budding nations that opposed the system. Angola, Mozambique, Namibia were turned into bitter battlefields. War and violence were the only languages that were used in maintaining the system against the encroachment of others. The system had built a buffer zone which had to be maintained at all costs. But at a certain stage, and this is very interesting for me, an ideological battle began to rage in the context of such an environment characterized by war and violence. Individual Christians and churches who shared the faith with the proponents of the system of apartheid began to question the system on the basis of the same faith. It's like the journalist asking Charles Taylor for his declaration that the war he was conducting was God's war. These churches and individual Christians questioned its premises and challenged it on the basis of the faith. Faithful who belonged in the church that supported and buttressed the policy of separate development or apartheid began to question it from within. People like the celebrated Dr. Beyers Naudé of the Dutch Reformed Church began to argue against the policy and its basis on the Christian scriptures. They argued that apartheid had no basis on the Christian scriptures and was rather a distortion of the faith. He even went so far as to establish an institute which brought black and white Christians to reflect together on the Christian faith. More and more leaders joined the discussion, the debate. Some of the prominent participants were Christian leaders such as the Reverend Alan Bosak, the Reverend Frank Chichikane, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu. The discussion within was joined and strengthened by discussions abroad. The World Council of Churches, where we are now, and its member churches were in the forefront of the discussion. They even went so far as to form the program to combat racism. They assisted liberation movements to fight racism wherever it manifested itself. This move caused uproar in many church circles. Even so, it could not stifle the heated debate that was raging on all sides and in various parts of the globe. It concerned the very survival of the Christian faith and the definition of its core values. The breakthrough came in the 80s. Some members of the Christian community in South Africa came up with a pithy but powerful phrase which condemned apartheid. They declared that apartheid is a heresy. In other words, they said that apartheid as a Christian-based policy was not in conformity with the norms of the Christian faith. They did not stop there. Some Christian organizations banned the South African Christian churches which supported and advocated the truth of apartheid. The public discourse and debate on the core values of the Christian faith had reached the conclusion that apartheid was no longer compatible with the norms of the Christian scriptures. This led to and contributed much towards the eventual demise of apartheid and the creation of a new South Africa. South Africa thus blazed a trail in which a religion-based ideology, which maintained itself on the basis of religiously approved violence, was discussed in the public square and found wanting on the basis of the scriptures. There are some situations in sub-Saharan Africa where religion-based politics has unleashed violence on a grand scale. These situations may be divided into four categories. One, some have tried to develop a sort of theocracy to govern the state. Such is the case with the Sudan, for example, and the attempt of the Lord's Resistance Army in Uganda. Second, some others have tried to impose their religious politics on others and ended up in a tug of war that also proved destructive in the course of history. The case in point is the Horn of Africa, especially Ethiopia, where the tug of war between Christianity and Islam was extremely important and at some points in history was very, very destructive. Nigeria, of course, is another example, and Ivory Coast. Third, some others have simply failed to agree on a common understanding of the same faith, as was the case with apartheid, and descended into chaos. This is the case of Somalia, where Islam is the sole religion. But instead of serving as a unifying factor, the different interpretations of the faith have lent themselves to contradictory political courses. And number four, then there are the simmering tensions that arise due to religion-based political claims which are affecting Eastern Africa. I take the examples of Kenya, Uganda, and Tanzania. Muslim claims on the establishment of Sharia-based institutions and Christian resistance to such claims are potential forms, sources of violence. Now, I could have gone to deal with the particular issues affecting some countries, but I think our time is running out. So I end up by presenting some of the steps, initiatives taken by religious leaders to bring about peace and bring an end to violence. I take examples from different parts of the continent. I start especially with Mozambique, where a courageous call by a prominent leader of the church somehow creates waves and brings an end to the war. In Mozambique, Cardinal Alexandre, the Archbishop of Maputo, in the pastoral letter of 15th April 1990 says, "There must be an end to war. There must be reconciliation between Frelimo and Renamo. And the arms which massacre the people must be silent." That is a very courageous statement coming from a religious leader. And I also delve into some of the intercontinental initiatives for peace which stand out among the many local church and interreligious initiatives. I deal with the Interfaith Action for Peace in Africa, where the Lutheran World Federation especially has been very active. The African Council of Religious Leaders, Religions for Peace. This is especially related to the World Conference on Religions for Peace. And then a latecomer, especially in this area, but very active in Christian-Muslim relations in Africa, PROCMURA, the Program for Christian-Muslim Relations in Africa. Even though they are separate organizationally and do work together in some cases, their main aim has been to address the many conflicts, both religion-based and others, to understand them, to alleviate the suffering of the people, to create dialogue, and to bring about peace. In such efforts, they bring together and use the capacities of believers of the various faiths and work to create a peaceful environment. They also engage themselves in campaigns against HIV/AIDS, human rights advocacy, and other activities. Human security is an overarching concept that ACRL RFP is working on. This also applies to all of them, even though they approach it in different ways. On the face of it, the prospect for religion-based approach to peacemaking has a great potential in sub-Saharan Africa. In the first place, Africans still remain extremely religious. They breathe religion. For whatever reasons, Africans are extremely religious. While this has also its negative side, it may also be used in a positive way. Secondly, religious leaders are held in very high esteem. They are respected far more than any other leaders. A recent poll showed that as many as 70 to 80% of the sub-Saharan population trust religious leaders. Therefore, they have the potential to play a positive role in working for peace. Thirdly, religion-based violence has been rare in sub-Saharan Africa so far, I say. How long this will last is anybody's guess. But the basis for sustaining peace in the face of religion-inspired violence has a positive start. The main forum for this search for peace is public discourse in the public square in the way of South Africa. I thank you for your attention. Thank you.